right? By now, all of you know that I love stories. Almost every kind of story. Myths, fairy tales, anecdotes from history, personal anecdotes, and even naughty jokes. And it's all right because we're going to be talking about a lot of things that are outside of the scope of experience of most people. It's all right if you consider everything that is said tonight a story. Because it's going to be all things that are otherworldly to a large extent. Now, one of my favorite books of stories is A Story Itself. It's by Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace and Anna Karenina. But he was a mystical aspirant, and he was a vegetarian. And he even tried to be a celibate with infamous unsuccess. He kept preaching the doctrine of salvation through celibacy, and his wife kept having one child after another, and it became quite a thing. But he wrote this story, which is a lot of the stories, traditional stories from Russia. It is called Stories We Tell. The story about it for me is a friend of mine that I liked very much had this book and lent it to me to read, and I fell in love with it, and it isn't something you can get easily. I don't know, I haven't checked on the internet lately, but I coveted that book. And then that friend made friends with yet another friend and loved that other friend so much that she gave the book to the other friend. This is what happens when you covet things. But several years ago, the other friend died. And I inherited all of the books from the other friend, including this one. But I knew it should go back to the owner, the original owner, because there was a sentimental tie between the two of them. And it stood on my bookshelf for a few months, and I mulled it over in my head. I knew that the original owner wouldn't even have remembered it, but I sent it back anyway. There are all kinds of stories in it. Some of them have been made into television shows. One of them is called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And it was a man that was always greedy about having so much land, and he always wanted more, and then he was told that there was a place out in the steppe that they would give him as much land as he wanted. And he went there and he meets the tribal chieftain, and the tribal chieftain says, you can have as much land as you can go around, circulate around in one day's time. You must start at sunrise and you must end at sunset. And so he takes off on a run, and he gets way far away, and he has big hunk of land set out for himself, and then he sees there's a little lake. And he says, if I run around that lake, and then one thing after another, he got, you know, was always greedy for something, and he came back, and he came right to the starting spot exactly at sundown, and he fell over dead. And the chieftain says something like he got all the land that he needed. And there's a famous story in there about the Archbishop of Archangel going out to visit his see, and he gets to this island. He's going along through the islands, and he says, what's that over there? And he says, well, there are three very strange monks there that all they do is pray all day long, every day, all year. He says, well, let me go over and see them. And they go over and see him, and the Archbishop says, how do you pray? And he said, we join hands together and we point at the sun and we say, thee are three and we are three, have mercy on us. And the Archbishop says, that's not how you pray. And he spends the entire day teaching them the Lord's Prayer. And they're not very smart. And they don't have good memories, and they don't get it. And finally, toward the end of the day, he thinks he's got them learning the prayer, and that they know it, and that he can leave, and he's going on the boat, and they get a few miles away, and he sees something over the water. And here it is, the three monks are coming, running over the top of the water, and they say, "Oh, Archbishop, teach us how to pray. We need to know how to pray. And he says, "Do what you were doing. It works. And the story that is relevant is one that is called Anything You Wish. It's a story of a man who's on a journey somewhere. You picture him like with one of those sticks with a little fardel hanging on the end of the stick, and he's walking along, and he finds some kind of injustice, and he writes it. Somebody was treating somebody else cruelly, and he doesn't think anything about it, and he goes around the bend, and the person who was being beaten comes up to him and says, "I am an angel, and whatever you want for the rest of the day, just say it, and it will be given to you." And he goes continuing on his walk, and he sees somebody that is admonishing a child, and then he sees all sorts of things. And in each case, he sees what he thinks is wrong, and he says, "Let it be this way." And he gets his wish each time. So that's why it's called Whatever You May Wish. And at the end of the day, the angel meets him again and says, "Would you like to see the results of your work?" And he goes back, and in each incident, he thought he was doing the right thing, but he didn't know better, and he was speaking from ignorance when he had things corrected. And in each case, the wish that he had was something that made things worse instead of better. And so the moral of the story, or one of the morals of the story, is it's not wise to assume that we know something that we really don't know. And we're going to be talking about things as though we were assuming, but keeping that in mind. Now, this is the beginning of another new subsection of these talks. So we have to review everything we've done. First, we had three introductory talks. The astronomical introductory talk, which told us what the when the Aquarian Age is. And then we had a talk, the flagship talk, that described the ideas of precession of the equinox and other astronomical, astrological tools for understanding history. And in the third talk, we talked about the evolution of cultural vehicles, and we used astrology as the cultural vehicle. Then we had the 11 mandalic talks, in which we related other signs of the zodiac back to Aquarius. We still have one of those pending, and that'll come in the final sub-series. And we did three talks on time and creation, and the last two talks that we have done, or the most recent two talks that we have done, were on social matters and matters of self-governance. Now, this one and the next two are going to be about framing things cosmologically with regard to the Aquarian Age, especially immediate focus of such a framing. Now, some of the talks in the past were difficult because they were intellectually challenging. Like the dot game was a very difficult talk to go through because it was very, very abstract. These may be difficult in a different way because they are about things about which we think we might know them, but perhaps really don't. So this is the reason for the telling of the story, Anything You Wish. The challenge for me and for others who have studied mysticism is to not fall prey to assuming that we know the things are as they are. All right. Let's look at this new sub-series. Let's work into it by looking at a story that we have returned to several times, a very important story. And we'll talk about it again even after tonight. We talked in the past about an imbalance in humanity, an imbalance such that we have demanded too much experience, especially sensory experience, and in that especially sensualistic sensory experience. And we have too little insight. There isn't a balance between experience and insight into the meaning of experience. And in the past, we have stated the mystical idea that this was the result of the fall into humanity. The fall is or was because we used creative power procreatively before we knew how to use it harmoniously with the cosmos. And as a result, we plunged ourselves into matter through sensuality, and now it's gotten so bad that we're blinded and ignorant and we have very little insight. According to the story, shortly after the separation of the sexes, which was done to accommodate continuance as we were coming into the physical plane, so that we could have evolutionary progress and share bodies or bring in new bodies for people who were returning to this plane. So the separation of the sexes occurred, and then the fall of humanity was shortly thereafter. When we say shortly thereafter, we're talking about things that may be thousands of years. So there are two fundamental factors to balance: experience and insight, and male and female physical experience. It's very different when you're in a male body versus when you're in a female body. According to the story, there is yet another general division, and that division is much deeper and it's much more long-lasting, because a rebirth in a body, be it male or female, is only for one cycle of rebirth, and you get to alternate back and forth. But what we're talking about is a division that could be called a division into male and female individualities. Let's look at this through a different version of the Adam and Eve story. We're familiar with that one. And this version is backed up not by the Bible completely, a little bit by the Bible, but more by the Dead Sea Scrolls and a lot of other Gnostic writings. There's a Gnostic show on in Milwaukee, and I'm sure they'll have some of the scrolls and writings there that tell the story in this fashion. According to all versions of the story, Adam and Eve had three sons, Abel, Cain, and Seth. And each of them had different origins, and each of them represents a different segment of humanity. Abel was pure and innocent. He was the result of a union that was done in innocence. And as a result, he represents humanity that passed away. He was murdered by Cain, but he represents humanity that never fell. And because that segment of humanity never fell, it never had to come into the material plane as deeply as the rest of us. According to the Gnostic sources, Cain was a child of Eve and the Lucifer spirit, Samael. And though the Lucifer spirit is always called semi-demonic or semi-divine, and it's given different names in different renditions. Cain was thus a different kind of human being, a kind of semi-human, semi-otherworldly, created or creative, and at the same time tainted by the fall. He was the murderer, after all. After the loss of Abel, the Bible tells us that Adam knew Eve, so that there was carnal knowledge, and it was not a completely innocent union, and she bore Seth. And so he was a human, completely human, not a completely pure, innocent human, but a completely complete human. All of the children of Seth are called the Son of Man, which includes Jesus many generations down the way. And since Eve couldn't be with the Lucifer spirit, all of the children of Cain are called sons of the widow, because she was left widowed. And if you look throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, you find this wording, only with no explanation to it. The mystical interpretation of this story indicates that there is a polar division in the individualities of humanity. It parallels the separation of the sexes, but it is much deeper and it's much more fundamental. It's much more long-lasting. It lasts for as long as we are individuated, until we become united in life spirit. So, we may be male or female in body from one life or in another life, but in terms of the gender of our individuality, we are a male individuality or a female individuality for our whole entire career. There are definite but parallel characteristics in both. The children of Seth are the children of water. I got to make sure that I got this all written down wrong. The children of Seth are the children of water. They are feelers. They are authoritarian. They appeal to hierarchy. They have heart orientation. And they are called Catholics. And when they achieve heights of spiritual development, they are called mystics in the sense that they approach through feeling. The children of Cain are the children of fire. They are thinkers rather than feelers. And they are independent rather than authoritarian. They are very head-oriented. In general, they are called masons. And when they achieve great levels, they are occultists. Now, we're not going to go into the story in great detail. We could. It's very fascinating. It's worth a whole series of talks. But that would take us too far away from what our intent is. Instead, let's look at one thing, and that is the advancement of our fallen humanity. There are very good people among the firelings and very good people among the waterlings. There is no greater advancement between either one of them, but the method of advancement is different. The firelings believe in doing, in educating, so that people know why they do what they do, and they believe in creation. But there is no substitute for humble obedience. And developing that in people is what the waterlings teach. So they're both involved with the advancement of humanity, but each in different ways. And each of them had help. This is where this begins to sound like science fiction, which is why I'm saying it should be treated like a story. The children of water had help from the Venusians. The Venusians were people of our life wave, whose evolution was associated with the planet Venus. They didn't necessarily come into physical bodies like this, but they straggled a little bit. And in order to make up their deficiency, they came here and helped us. They were like ringers. You know, you bring in a ball player that's really a hot shot from another league, so to speak, and you pad your roster with that. The firelings had the Mercurians, who were people from the planet Mercury, who were in a similar situation. And each of them did things to help humanity. The Venusians instituted priest kings, who were both spiritual priests and were kings. They even had physical characteristics that differentiated them from other people. This is perfectly logical because they believed in the appeal to authority. The Mercurians produced the Hierophants of the Mysteries. And instead of starting kingdoms and religions, they started mystery schools. The waterlings do things by faith. The firelings do things not without faith, but the emphasis is on works. And if you read carefully the New Testament of the Bible, the struggles between the different people writing in the New Testament of the Bible, it was a big struggle between those who believed in faith and those who believed in works. It's still present to this day. There are people who believe that once you've had a conversion to Christ, you don't need to do anything else. The only thing you need to do is accept Christ, and everything else is done for you. You don't have to live any special kind of life or anything like that. Of course, that to the firelings like ourselves, it's not a very pleasant thing. Now, all of these distinctions are not overwhelming so that you can walk down the street and point at somebody, look at him, he's surely a fireling. It's not like that. It's more of an attitude. Probably everyone in this room is a fireling, or you wouldn't be in this room, because this is all about understanding what we're doing and working self-consciously with what we're doing. The speaker is very clearly a fireling. He doesn't only know what needs to be done, he has to know why it has to be done and what is the best way that it can be done. These talks are influenced by the mystery schools. Now, in the past, there has always been a rivalry between the firelings and the waterlings. But since the incarnation of Christ in the body of Jesus, there is to be a unity between the two of them. That is, the waterlings, with their purity of faith, are supposed to influence us to live more by faith. And we, on the other hand, if the faith takes in us, we are to educate them. So this unification process is symbolized in the Gospels by the raising of Lazarus. According to the story, Cain was at another lifetime Hiram, the builder of the Temple of Solomon, and Solomon himself, Bible tells us, was Adam, and at other times Jesus. Well, the Bible tells us Jesus, but not necessarily Adam. But by putting the two together, you get that. Again, according to the story, which is called the Masonic myth, Lazarus was a rebirth of Cain, or Hiram, and thus he was the builder's builder, the magician's magician, and so on. So the raising of Lazarus was also known as him being the beloved of Christ. And at that right raising, he was given two symbols, a cross and a rose, which differentiates things. The cross that was given was not a cross like a plus sign, which is a generative cross. It is an elongated cross in the bottom leg of the cross, which is the symbol of sacrifice. The rose differentiates from the monocots, the lilies. All of the pre-Christian things were primarily dedicated to, they were very mystical in nature. They had the lily, especially the lotus, as their symbol. And so the teaching that is, or the what is given to the being that became known by these two symbols, Christian Rosenkreutz, is to be a teacher of a new creative way, a way that is scientific and that builds rather than everything opening at once, trembling open like a lotus, but where things come in spirals like the petals of a rose. Now, it's important to know that when we mention these things, we're not just name-dropping. We should be humbled and humiliated by it, because in all of these people, so many great people have been great people in their lives before, and it means that all the rest of us never were anything but laggards along the way. Now, the mystery schools, both the ancient ones and the modern ones, the lilies and the roses, are aligned to yet another differentiation of humanity. It is the differentiation, they are aligned to light broken down. That is to say, if you take light and break it into a spectrum, you have the rainbow of seven colors. And apparently at the same time that there was the division into male and female individualities, there was a division to belonging to one of seven different rays. Now we're talking about something very, very recondite. This is very, very deep, and one needs profound spiritual faculties to determine what ray someone belongs to. But at any rate, the mystery schools are set up according to the rays. Each of the colors of the rays has specific characteristics to it, and those characteristics are reflected in attitudes. Those attitudes are to some small extent influenced by religion, and to some small extent they are influenced by cultural things, but basically the attitudes are attuned to the character of the people, which is the character of each of the colors. Now, we're not going to go into all of the seven rays either, because that would take us far away from where we want to go to. These talks are influenced by a ray that is associated with the Rosicrucians. And I want to give the characteristics of this ray so you can understand where we are coming from and why we're going to take the attitude that we are about the information. One characteristic is self-reliance. Not independence, which is a very different thing, but self-reliance. One does not go crying to a master saying, help me, help me, help me. In a self-reliant way, we try to figure things out on our own. This is a very common thing among firelings. Firelings respect each and every person. Some of the Gnostic schools, the least member of the organization was allowed to give the doctrine of the day, and everybody listened respectfully. Another characteristic of the work of the Rosicrucians is balancing the heart and the head, which is an activity and an attitude. We try to blend the activity of the heart, that is, the things that we do from the blood, with the things from the nervous system. And this balance is of very great importance. In fact, Rosicrucian students, almost all of them, become very mystical during their career within the influence, because they already are inclined mentally, but they need very much more to develop the heart. A third characteristic is service, self-forgetting service, which also is an attitude. It's not any particular kind of action. It's things that are done with an attitude of service, with an attitude of helping things go along. In the Mysteries of Thor, one of the things in the Mysteries of Thor is they had Thor's cart. And in the mystery, the candidate for initiation had to pull the cart along, meaning to say that we participate in the doing of things. Everything is participatory, and when we have that attitude of helping things get along, that is an important thing. Another characteristic of the Rosicrucian outlook is an emphasis on healing. Not only physical healing, but psychological healing. Changing bad attitudes, regenerating them into something positive. Feeling that not so much individual development is important, but that everyone makes it. Because it's more important that we all be as one than it is important that all the pieces are in a puzzle. If all the pieces aren't there, there's a gaping hole. This is even a stronger factor in the redemption of humanity. And the final factor of the major factors that influence the Rosicrucian stream is that it is very cosmological. That is, all of the spiritual exercises that are used in the Rosicrucian movement are based on cosmological principle. Because we are a product of the cosmos. We are not separate from it. Everything we are is a consequence of a cosmological process. And therefore, to unfold it and to develop new things out of our being, it is much easier, safer, and better accomplished if we are working in harmony with the principles upon which we are built. All right, so these things are united in the most central activity of the Rosicrucian movement. And that is what our talk and the next two talks are going to be about. The central most activity at this time in our evolution is helping all of humanity to take the next step forward. We're not talking about something on the distant cosmological horizon. We're not talking about something that is dear to us religiously. This is a matter of there are changes coming cosmologically, and that it is important that we prepare everyone to be ready to take the next major step in the evolutionary creation. Obviously, since this is a group of firelings, question comes along, what is the next step? Because it's a questioning group. To answer that question requires a restatement of the whole evolutionary creation which we participate, at least the solar evolutionary creation. We've done this a few times before, and we will probably do it a few times more, only each time we'll look at it differently. This time I intentionally tried to do things in a way different than the way I normally do them. And again, this topic of describing what we are and where we are and what's going on is going to be painfully brief. Before there could be a cosmic manifestation, there had to be the possibility of a cosmic manifestation. And in Christian mysticism, that is called potential. From our waking, testable experience of reality, there is a common experience. We understand not only that there are things that are, but things that could be. As soon as we learn something, we have a bunch of more questions, or we could see that there's some more things that could be. And that could be is what potential is a fancy name for. Potential stands between being and non-being. Non-being just doesn't exist. Potential means it could exist, but yet doesn't. So we have, between being and non-being, we have a gray zone. We have a dualism that's implied between being and non-being, but since everything from non-being that passes through potential into being, it has to have belonged to the same thing. There has to be a unity, or that wouldn't be possible. So it isn't a pure dualism. It is a unified dualism. So we have being and non-being and potential between them, and things go back and forth between being and non-being. Now, the great scientific seers claim that between pure being, which has only the spirit of existence, and non-being, which is a dark zone, a black zone, so to speak, that between the light or whiteness of pure existence and the darkness of non-existence, there is suspended, you might say, a spectrum or a rainbow of states of being. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, they are called worlds. In these worlds, the great evolutionary process takes place. They constitute the fields of activity for evolution to be accomplished. Now, within these different worlds are many, many sub-worlds, and there's so many things that it's impossible to take the sub-differentiations and sub-sub-differentiations, because this is something very, very complicated. There are parallels between each of the worlds, and those parallels are understood by analogy, as described in the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below. What has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. So we know that. So these worlds are states of being, states of God, so to speak. And in them, the great process of the evolutionary creation takes place. Within them are many, many co-creators. It isn't like the creator is a human-like being that is very, very fast and does all of the creation, like making a million ceramic pieces in the flash of a second. It is a process where many beings, which could be called gods. In the Bible, they're called Elohim. They're called creative hierarchies. Doesn't make any difference. The conscious, divine, creative beings are at the spirit end, the light end, the pure being end of the pole, whereas the creatures that are coming into being, that have the potential of being anything and everything that the other beings are already, are at the matter end. So we have the spirit-matter pole. So that it is a rainbow or a spectrum that is not just different colors, not just different tones, but it is different states of being, different densities of being, each of which has its own logic. In fact, the whole business is like a logic of a statement or of a line of a poem or something like that, the relation of each world to each other. But we're not going to go into that. I would like to, but... Now, the whole process is cyclical. Spirit works its way into matter and back out, and back in and back out, and there are all these sub-states, and each it goes progressively deeper. The process out of the worlds, proto-forms are developed, or forms that are pro-evolutionary for specific action to be taken. And they are called globes. And the evolutionary process takes place in time. So there are periods of time. And the winding into matter and winding back out is a revolution of consciousness. So the whole creative evolutionary process, evolutionary creative process, takes place in time and space matter, and it involves a revolution of consciousness. It's progressive, because once something has been experienced, it can't be unexperienced. Once you know something, you can't unknow something. So it is progressive, and the revolutions of consciousness are just not running in circles. They are a spiral that goes forward. So spirit enters into matter and then withdraws. During the first half of the evolutionary creation, which is far, far older than materialistic cosmology thinks. Materialistic cosmology, talking about 15 or 17 billion years, that's just a Johnny-come-lately time. That's just talking about the reprecipitation of physical matter. But in the first half of the evolutionary creation, it is called involution. And spiritual creation or spirit becomes materialized in forms that comprise the globes. In the second half, the essence of the experience of matter is taken out. All of the beings keep moving forward as creative beings, but the essence of experience is drawn out of matter and it is taken into the spirit, and that is called the evolutionary half. Throughout the entire process, there is awakening of consciousness. However, becoming beings first pass from an all-conscious but not waking consciousness, they pass into a state of deep unconsciousness so that they can obtain objectivity. They have to give up blissfulness in order to obtain objectivity. So there are seven globes in seven that work in four worlds at a time, but there are seven worlds. There are several seven periods of time with sub-periods and epochs and sub-sub-periods and such. And there are seven revolutions going through all of these stages. There are stages for becoming beings where there are form only, which is a mineral-like stage. And from the mineral-like stage all the way to the godlike stage, there is a continuum of beings, of creative beings with various degrees of waking consciousness. There are waves of beings that are constantly coming in the process and leaving, and others leaving and going on to other evolutions or going into rest in the, how do you say it, in the depths of the absolute. So we have things phased off, just like we are in a human stage. Our animals are in the animal-like stage, but in a previous period, we were in an animal-like stage. And so there, it's like the petals of a rose, one after another. All of this takes place in multiple dimensions. Now, materialistic science, working from observation and estimation, which is something that they do quite well, believe that right now in the world there are between 5 million and 100 million species. The best estimate that they have that I could find from a reputable source on the internet was that it's at this time they think there are 10 million species on the Earth. And studying paleontology and deducing from paleontology, they claim that 99.9 of all of the species that have ever been are gone, never to return. Now, some of them morphized into other things, but this means that there are many, many species. So if we consider all of these species and the microclimates in which all of them evolve, this is a very impressive thing. But it is as naught compared to all of the different states that we pass through in the evolutionary creation. There are many, many, many states of being. We're talking about something that is an enormous activity. And it's not complexity for its own sake. The universal spirit doesn't waste just to show how diverse it can be. It is that the spirit, pure spirit, is capable of many, many different facets. And in an evolutionary creation with all of these varying circumstances, different sides are brought out by different kinds of experience. So all of this then is to awaken many, many possible characteristics of our basic spiritual being. Now this is all done in a very simple way. It is done by taking a few simple principles and playing them against themselves again and again and again. It's like a gigantic fugue. There are seven worlds. One set of names for them are the world of God, the world of virgin spirit, divine spirit, life spirit, world of thought, desire world, and physical world. The world of thought by function is divided between abstract thought in three sub-realms and concrete thought in four sub-realms. And the physical world, in which we exist now, it is subdivided into three sub-realms that we know as realms or states, I guess you would say, solids, liquids, and gases. And the other four are the etheric subdivision of the physical world. Now the seven periods of time are called Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, Jupiter, Venus, Vulcan. The seven revolutions have the same names. The first revolution is Saturn, the second Sun, the third Moon, and so on. The four globes, in most circumstances, are called A, B, C, D, E, F, G, so as not to confuse them with the planets that are in the heavens. But I think it's wisest they should be called, the globes should be called Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, and so on. All right. We are currently in the fourth of seven revolutions in the Earth period. And we are in the deepest globe in materialization, not only for this period, but for the entire creation. Globe D, the Earth globe, if you like that term. And that includes all of the physical matter of the solar system, not just our planet, but all of the physical matter. We're trying to get to the next step. To do that, we have to know where we are. We know a little bit where we are and where we have been, a little bit, and where we are going. So let's review our past a little more, but let's do it with extreme brevity. And in doing so, we'll again limit ourselves to only the human life wave. In the Saturn period, when the densest of the four worlds that were the operative worlds for the seven globes was thought, we were mineral life. We were thought minerals. And we learned to take form, to take shape, and that was our material world. But in that activity, resistance is as important as pliability, being able to take shape. So in the Vulcan Revolution, which is the last revolution, by learning the lessons of resistance from the first revolution, that of Saturn, of mineral-like form, we developed the capacity of the will to withstand resistance, so that at the end of the Saturn period we had a physical nature or the physical ability to take form, and we had the will to be. And there was a big rest. And then in the Sun period, the whole business went deeper into matter. And the deepest of the globes went as far as the desire world. And in that Sun period, we had learned from all the other beings, because everything is completely democratic in the night of rest. So all goes back to pure spirit, and all the experience gets percolated through all beings. And in the Sun period, we went through a plant-like existence. That is, we developed the ability to take and hold and vitalize life, vital life. So we developed a vital nature. And that vital nature was such that we could grow and that we could change form and do things like that. In the sixth revolution of the Sun period, which is the Venus revolution, we awakened in the spirit, the life spirit, which is associated light and all imagination that is done in light, so that the second spiritual attribute, which is called life spirit, that was developed by going through different forms and learning how to grow different forms, the ability to imagine any kind of form was developed. And then in the last revolution, that was connected with the divine spirit or the will to be. Another cosmic night of rest after that. We were then a complete plant-like existence. We had a physical nature and a vital nature, and we had an imaginative spirit, and we had the will to be. And then we had that rest when there was assimilation, and there was pondering and creative dreaming, and everything is shared all states of being. In the Moon period, things became even more dense, and the cosmos became as dense as the ethers, which for most people is what science would call electromagnetism, which is not really a good thing. But we went through an animal-like existence. We were able to detach from the common globe and to move. And in order to be able to do that, we had to have desire, because desire gave us the motive ability to move about. And so that was our work in the first three revolutions. Now all of these things are built within. Everything works from within out. before we could become plant-like, we had to go all the way back to the beginning and have a physical body that was capable of having a life body within it. And before we could become animal-like, we had to have a physical body that could accommodate a vital nature within it, and that had to be, and both of them had to be able to accommodate having motive desire within them. In the fifth revolution, the Jupiter revolution, the idea of a self was developed from having an independent, movable, complex body of physical, vital, and emotional. That individual body, that experience, wakened up the idea of an individual being, a self. And so, at the end of the moon period, we were a threefold body and a threefold spirit. We had a dense physical body capable of substance, shape, and physical experience. And it was capable of experiencing things externally. And in its taking of shape, it had rudimentary objectivity. We had a vital body, which was capable of growth and vitality, and it was capable of energy and movement and flow, and it was capable of picking up things and transporting them. And we had a desire body. We were capable of motivating. We were capable of feeling the character of something within ourselves. And we could experience the color of life. In spirit, we had a divine spirit, which is the complement of the physical body, which is the will to be. And the will to do the basic creation. And it is an unmoved mover. And it is so subtle that it is ever invisible, and it is there just as a power. In reflection from the vital body, we have a life spirit that understood the purpose of life, why life lives, had the imagination to carry out the creation that comes from the power of the divine spirit. And it was capable of visible manifestation of the divine spirit as light in the life spirit. And it was completely other-oriented. That's the only way the integrity of the all, the love, the unifying altruistic love that we've been talking about all the way, all through these talks, could take place. And corresponding to the desire body, its reflection was a human spirit, which was capable of conceiving ideas and manifesting them. It is a being. It is a being that does things. It is the doer. It is the thinker. It is the self that is behind all of the functions of the various vehicles of consciousness. It has the color of character, of spiritual character. Now, these vehicles of consciousness and states of spirit are at varying degrees of development. Obviously, the dense physical body, which has been around for a much, much longer time, is extremely sophisticated. It has all kinds of things for contingency conditions, and it can live under very, very harsh states of environment. All of the vehicles are vehicles of consciousness for the spirit. And all of them have evolved significantly, even in the Earth period. Now, the work of the Earth period has been to develop a concrete mind within the desire nature, within the vital nature, and within the physical nature. And this concrete mind, since it is an expression of the focus of the threefold spirit, the human spirit, the self can then enter into its vehicles and experience them from within and evolve them and create and do all of the wonders that are done in the world. This is a this has been our work. We're waking up. We're bringing the spirit into the bodies through the link of our mind. The concrete mind becomes the doorway between personality and individuality, between matter and spirit. And this has been our work for the first 3.5 revolutions of the Earth period. Now we're just past the nadir of materiality, and this is something that sounds very strange to material scientists. The idea is that the cosmos, or the matter of our solar cosmos, used to be more dense than it is now. And this is a concept that science doesn't like. The science likes the laws of nature to remain ever constant, and the whole idea that there is a relativity between what are considered constants is enough to freak people out. And this is why mental people so much need to develop all of that faith so that they can accomplish this kind of awareness of variable constants, which sounds like a self-contradictory statement. So we are in the fourth revolution of the Earth period, and we're on globe D, and we're passing toward globe E, because nothing stands still in evolution. Progress forward or we regress backwards. Even if we just try to keep time, we fall backwards because everything else is progressing. This is especially pertinent because we become self-consciousness. We become self-conscious at a time in our development. As we do that, we become more responsible for our participation. So it is important for us to be able to anticipate and to understand what is coming next. This is why we go through this scheme of evolution many times from many points of view, because the better we understand it, the more we are able to anticipate and get the most out of the experiences, because we know what's coming. Even if it's only intellectual knowing, it is something us. It's as Hamlet says, the readiness is the all. Now all religions try to do this. All religions, well, we'll take the example from Christianity, claim there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. You find the same thing in Northern European mythology, that there's going to be a destruction of the earth and there's going to be a new one after that. In terms of what we've just said, that our current evolution is between this dense physical plane and the self in the region of abstract thought, where we have the experience of the Holy Spirit. Right now, what is right for us is to have the experience of the Holy Spirit. Some people are not prepared for that intellectually, and so they have to have something like glossolalia, to have that kind of experience so that they know the truth of it. Others are more capable of forming the ideas and of it dawning on them what they really are and what their divine being and divine propensities are, and that is the order of the day. In our life cycle, we go no deeper than the region of human spirit. We pass through the world of thought, and the desire world, and the physical and etheric regions, and we touch into the region of ideational thought. The new heaven is when we will penetrate into the life spirit. This is what real Christianity is all about. It means that our selfhood will be given over to the self of all selves. that which always lives for the other, which is the only way that altruistic love in an absolute sense is possible. So, the new heaven is life spirit. The new earth is globe E. And globe E is manifest in the etheric region of the physical world. There is coming a time when the solids, liquids, and gases are going to be dissolved, and that our life cycle will run between life spirit and the ethers. And since we are responsible, we have to prepare ourselves and make ourselves fit in order to be able to enter into the new earth. It isn't going to be done for us. Now that we are self-conscious, we are responsible for our own evolution. So, the Bible tells us that if you don't have the wedding garment, which is a symbolic shorthand for the etheric vehicle that we're going to need, especially the soul body part of the etheric vehicle, we cannot progress forward. We'll be only as conscious as we are when we are asleep, which is not very conscious. So, this is really important. It's really important that we learn to develop in the ethers, that we learn to function in the ethers. And when we're talking about the Aquarian Age, we have said all along that Aquarius rules the ethers. And so what we're talking about here is the ability to build the etheric vehicle so that we can continue on in evolution. And so the title for this talk is A Look at the Ethers. All right. Now, let's start working into understanding the ethers. Let's start with a few very simple questions. We're not going to be, at least in this talk, we're not going to be extremely knowledgeable. We're just going to touch on things this is meant for anybody at large. What are the ethers and how do we experience them? So let's try to follow the cosmological process. Begin with experience and then follow with understanding. That's the way it was. We had a physical body before we could have the will to be. Now, my own personal experiences with the ethers were both subtle and dramatic. One was very slow and subtle because it seemed forever that it was going to take forever for me to grow up. I wanted to have bigger shoes. I wanted to have big man shoes. You know how that is, and you put those marks on the door, and how big are you now? And then you look at your father's mark, which is constant, but it's way up there. Everybody has gone through that. It was very subtle. The more dramatic experience of the ethers was when my brother told me to pee on the electric fence. I learned that the energy, which in that case is electrical energy, which is etheric energy in decay, I understood how powerful and dramatic it was, even though it couldn't be seen.